we appear to be ready to roll. Let's move from mutual funds to bankruptcy. 20-1376, Rodriguez versus Barrera. Mr. Wadsworth, you're for the appellant. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Dave Wadsworth. I am the attorney for the Chapter 7 trustee in the underlying case, Simon Rodriguez. Today's appeal presents a single issue of statutory construction, which is given de novo review. The statute in question is Section 348 F1A of the Bankruptcy Code, which defines what property of the Chapter 7 bankruptcy estate consists of when a case converts from Chapter 13 to Chapter 7. And the salient language is property of the converted estate, quote, shall consist of property of the estate, comma, as of the date of filing of the petition, comma, that remains in the possession of or is under the control of the debtor on the date of conversion. And there are two phrases in there that I think got all the attention in the bankruptcy court and in the BAP, and that's the phrase property of the estate and the phrase as of the date of filing of the petition. It's our position that neither one of those phrases has any ambiguous language. There's no word in there that is not subject to widespread understanding, as this court has phrased plain or unambiguous language in the McCow or McCuff case that's cited in the briefs. And so there's no reason to go beyond the plain language in interpreting it. The phrase property of the estate is a defined term in the bankruptcy code. It is section 541 of the bankruptcy code. That section is titled property of the estate, and subsection A defines what that consists of. And I think the bankruptcy court, the BAP, Judge Romero in the Hayes case, everyone agrees that the phrase property of the estate in this statute, 348 F1A, is the same as 541. There's no distinction there. It is exactly what that statute says. And 541A is incredibly broad. It has been defined or it has been interpreted by the Supreme Court in multiple cases. We cite just two in the brief that we think add some help to the interpretation here, the Rousey case and the Schwab case. Both of those cases talk about property of the estate being, well, I mean, so the language of the statute says it's all legal and equitable interests of the debtor on the date the case is filed. The Rousey and the Schwab case both talk about the statute means what it says. What comes into the estate is the property, and then you can later take pieces out. You can then make value decisions and carve, you know, pieces out for exemptions and so forth. But what comes into the estate is the property itself, all rights, all interests, everything that it comes with. And I think
we're talking about then kind of what happens when after the petition is filed, and you know, there's a broader principle here. You know, I think the facts are quite clear. As you've stipulated to here, but you know, what happens to appreciable assets that exist on day one? You used a stock example in your briefs. We have an appreciated home. It could be jewelry, you know, countless other assets. And I think your position would be that any appreciation in any asset would be property of the estate that would be distributable by the trustee at conversion. Is that right?
If the property interest existed on the date the case was filed, 100%, I totally agree, Your Honor. And the negative applies as well. If the property went down in value, the Chapter 7 estate would suffer that as well. But it is the asset with all attributes that is a property of the estate.
Yeah, so, and then I assume there's a schedule at the filing of the petition of all these, of the diamond rings and the Microsoft stock and the house on Mulberry Street, et cetera, right?
Yes.
In this case, the debtor sold the home before the conversion, and all those other examples, appreciated stock or appreciated jewelry, depreciated stock, all those could be sold before conversion. What is the trustee entitled to what those sold for before conversion, or do we go back to the filing date?
I think that you go to what is in the debtor's possession on the conversion date. That's the reasonable interpretation of 541A1 and A6. A1 is the property, A6 is the proceeds. And so if the debtor sells the property during the 13 and let's say, you know, generates $100,000, if he still has $100,000 when the case converts, then that's what comes into the Chapter 7 estate because that's what's in his possession. If he spends 50, then only 50 comes into the chapter 7 estate. It's dictated by what he remains in possession of.
Well, so the proceeds from the house and the bank, you get under your theory, but the debtor buys a boat or maybe a new house with the proceeds. Another valuable asset. Are those off limits because they've been somehow transformed into different assets, or can you claw back and make the debtor sell the boat or sell the ring or sell the vacation home?
So I think, those are facts that aren't present in this case.
No, but they're implicated by whatever rule you want us to adopt.
Well, sort of. All I'm asking is that the statute be interpreted or applied as exactly as it says. So what I would say to the question, Your Honor, is that absent a finding of bad faith, right? So if somebody in converting this asset into a boat, if there was some indicia of bad faith, that would be a separate issue. But if there's no indicia of bad faith, then the plain language again, the proceeds are no longer in the debtor's possession. I think the debtor has a pretty good argument there. That's not something the Chapter 7 trustee can recover.
Well, I know this isn't your case, but is it bad? I'm a debtor. I did the 13, trying to make it work, couldn't make it work. I know I'm heading into seven land. So I take my stuff and I sell it. That's my only avenue to preserve, cash somehow. Maybe your theory is that that's bad faith, although if it's permitted by the plain language of the statute, I'm not sure why that would be a credible bad faith argument, because they weren't really hiding anything from the trustee or from the creditors.
So I think my response to that, Your Honor, would be, and this kind of gets into the bankruptcy court's policy analysis, which we disagree with. In this case, and you can look at the plan, which is in the appendix, and I think it's at page 80 is the one I'm specifically referring to. In this case, the debtor proposed to pay $241 a month for the first couple of years of the plan, and then $263 for the last 3 years. So this case was converted, I think, 3 years into the plan. So they would have been at the $263 a month period. If they sold that house and they generated $150,000, you can't tell me that they couldn't have set aside $6,000 of that money to complete their plan payments and then fulfill the bargain that they struck with all their creditors and the bankruptcy court in the plan that they filed under penalty of perjury, and gotten their discharge. And that would have solved all of this. So this idea that somehow there's a disincentive to a Chapter 13 when what happens is happening in this case, I think it's a false premise. I mean, there's this asset, they could easily have continued making the payments under the plan and never had this issue arise.
Yeah, but that's not why we're here. We have to come up with an interpretation of the scheme that applies to countless variations. And I'm just trying to figure out what your limiting principle is here, and how we can come up with a consistent theory that conscientiously applies the statutory scheme to countless other fact patterns.
Well, so my response to that, Your Honor, I think the 348F1A answers the question. I mean, what does the debtor have in his or her possession on the date of conversion? And if that thing, whether it's cash or it's physical property, was something that was scheduled in the initial Chapter 7 case, then that comes into the Chapter 7 estate, period. I mean,
what's your theory? I think I understand from the briefs, but your theory on what work F2 does? The other side has said F2, and I think the bankruptcy judge has also said that would, lose any work under the theory of the case that you're advocating.
Yeah, I don't understand that argument, Your Honor, because F2, I mean, we are not advocating that after acquired property comes into the Chapter 7 estate. And so any wages earned after the bankruptcy filing, those are not going to come into the bankruptcy estate or any property. This would get into your boat example. I mean, I guess that is a possible loophole here where a debtor could convert Chapter 7 property or property of the estate into another asset and then argue it's after acquired and then therefore it doesn't come into the 7 estate.
What about an inheritance?
That also is governed by 541. If it is received more than 6 months after the initial filing, it's after acquired property, wouldn't come into the 7 estate. If it's acquired within 6 months of the bankruptcy filing, it is property that's seven to state and will come in.
That really seems like a pretty big loophole, you know, this conversion of proceeds from an asset to another asset.
I suppose that's possible, Your Honor, but I think we then get into, I wouldn't give this the bad faith argument such short shrift, because if somebody, in my example in this case, where the debtor had $6,000 that easily could have set aside to make payments, I think you could make a credible argument that somebody who was attempting to avoid the application of the bankruptcy code to keep, you know, to buy a yacht to avoid paying his creditors, I think you might be able
That's exactly what I would do now.
Well, but I think you make a bad faith argument there on that they have the ability to make these payments. They didn't need to convert. And so this really was designed to thwart the trustee. But even beyond all that, Your Honor, I guess I go back to this court's Miller decision, which I think the appellee cited and the BAP cited, and it goes into a lengthy discussion of when you look at legislative history. And this is not that case. This is not a case where you look outside of the language of the statute to policy, because it doesn't admit of any other meaning without adding language. And Miller says, and all other cases say, it's not the role of the judiciary to write statutes. It is to interpret what Congress said. If Congress didn't enact what they meant to enact, that's Congress's problem, not the courts. And so, I mean, I'm hung up on the idea of the possibility here of finding any ambiguity in the plain language, right? I mean, there's no phrase in 348 F1A that does not mean what it says. And so, whether there's a loophole or not, that's something that Congress can deal with at a later date, or it could be dealt with in a bad faith, or it could be a loophole that ends up happening. But I mean, I don't think that's the role of, in this appeal, that is something implicated that should be influencing the result.
Well, don't Chief Judge Timkovich's hypotheticals suggest, we have to look at the broad working of the statute, and don't they suggest that your interpretation in some ways, well, maybe not absurd, but approaches the line of being absurd, because then in this situation, the only thing that the debtor could have easily gone out and bought something. And then, it would just be the happenstance that at the time they converted, they had not purchased the yacht that allowed you to get access to money. Why does that make any sense? I mean, the notion that you have $100,000 in your pocket and you kept the cash, as opposed to converting the cash to an asset. And at least if I was understanding you correctly, the argument would be the trustee could not go after the yacht, but could go after the $100,000 in cash. What's the difference?
I think ultimately, Your Honor, the difference there is that there is something about the scenario that you've and Judge Timkovich have set up that smacks of bad faith. I mean, that does sound like you have something there, you've made a bargain with your creditors, they're going to pay a certain amount of money, you have the ability to pay it, and instead of paying it, you're going to convert an asset into a yacht and then walk away and leave your creditors high and dry. I mean, that smacks of bad faith to me.
Well, I would have thought the answer to my earlier question would be that you could claw back the yacht and distribute the proceeds to the creditors, because whether it's cash or yacht or anything else, it's all flows from the initial property of the estate. But that's not your position.
Well, I think that gets into different facts. I mean, I think that gets into the revestment argument, Your Honor. If the property hadn't revested, there may be a 549 post-petition avoidable transfer claim there for the trustee. But if the property is revested in the debtor under the plan, I'm not sure that same claim.
But typically under bankruptcy, when you're looking at property of the estate, it would be limited to proceeds and not then continue to trace it into further property. Is that right? So when you sell the house, if you have the $100,000, that's proceeds, so it falls under 541.
Right.
Right? Yep. If you take that $100,000 and using the hypothetical, you go buy the yacht, the typical interpretation of 541 would not further treat that as proceeds. Am I right?
Yes, but I think I'm not sure that's a fair hypothetical, because if we're in Chapter 7, for example, and I think this speaks to my last response to Mr. Justice Timkovich's question. If you're in a Chapter 7 and the debtor transfers property to the estate without authorization, turns it into a yacht, sells the house without authorization, turns it into a yacht, you would have a 549 claim against the yacht. Similarly, in the 13 context, you would, I believe, if the property hadn't revested in the case reconverted. So it's sort of a different issue. I think you still have a claim if that asset was property of the estate when it was wrongfully taken out and turned into something else.
Okay, so that may go to whether this interpretation is absurd because there's another way to deal with it in the code. Is that what you're arguing?
I'm not arguing that. I was simply answering what I thought was a question. I don't see how applying the statute exactly as it's written reaches an absurd result when it results in a better result for creditors. I don't see how that's possibly be so absurd. I apologize. I'm over my time.
No, that's okay. And then just to be clear, there's no, the devaluation of an asset, the depreciation of the house or the stock or the jewelry, the trustee bears the risk and the burden of that.
Absolutely. I mean, the property is the property. It's whether it goes up or down, that's what comes into the estate.
Okay. All right. I think we follow that. Let's hear from the appellee, Mr. Asbach.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Just following up
yourself for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Eric Otzbach. I represent the debtors in this case, Julio Cesar Barrera and Maria de la Luz Moro, who are also the appellees. Just to follow up on the comments, I've heard from the court that the court would like to find a very simple solution that it can apply to many different kinds of assets. And I'd like to caution the court that the bankruptcy code and Colorado state exemption laws, as well as probably the state exemption laws of all other states, treat a debtor's home in a very special way. And particularly in the case of a conversion of a case from Chapter 13 to Chapter 7. So I don't believe that the court's approach of trying to find a one-fits-all solution is going to work. I think you can find a one-fits-all solution regarding post-petition appreciation in a debtor's home, but that's going to be different than the treatment of other assets for reasons which I will go into.
Well, you know, if Congress treats them all the same, then don't we have to do what Congress says? I mean, there's nothing in this section on the effect of conversion that sets out a rule for the debtor's home than it does for any other property of the state.
I agree that the court has to do what Congress wants the court to do, and that is why the court should give great deference to Congress's explicitly stated intent in the legislative history to 348F1A regarding post-petition pre-conversion appreciation in a debtor's home.
Well, can we go to the legislative history if we don't think the language is ambiguous? I mean, Congress may have intended to do one thing, but the words on the page may not be consistent with that.
So this is what the Tenth Circuit has stated in New Mexico versus Department of Interior 854F3rd 1207. If Congress has spoken directly to the issue, that is the end of the matter. The court must give effect to Congress's unambiguously expressed intent. And that expressed intent is set forth in the legislative history to 348F1A. And in that history, the court gives an example of a debtor paying off $10,000 of equity in its house and then converting it. And the court, Congress stated explicitly that in such case, that post-petition increase in equity should go to the debtor. So,
what would you say your best argument is not relying on the House report? Your best textual argument?
The best argument not relying on the House report?
Your textual argument.
the other argument would be that the one would be the same argument that was discussed by Judge Brown, which is that there's a difference between the proceeds and the house itself. And Judge Brown made the point that we're discussing Judge Romero's decision in the Hayes case. Judge Brown pointed out that, you know, according to Judge Romero, the proceeds were different, but the property is not different. So on one hand, Judge Romero said, well, you know, the house is the property and that's the end of the story. But then he also goes on to say, well, we also have the proceeds and it's kind of the same thing, but we have to go to this other statute. That would be the other argument.
I'm not following that argument. You have to go to the other statute. What other statute?
I believe it's 541A6.
Okay, so you're saying the use of the term property of the estate should be defined by going to 541, which is in fact a definition of property of the estate.
Yeah.
I see that helps you.
And A6 is proceeds, right?
Yeah, A6 is the proceeds. And so Judge Brown's critique of Judge Romero's decision was that the property is one thing, but then he also has to go to 541A6 to get the proceeds in. So it's actually two separate things.
But they're both property of the estate, right?
Well, not according to Judge Brown. I'd have to go back. Judge Brown raises the issue that it may not be property of the estate. But is it okay if the court, if it would please the court, I'd like to make my arguments about the legislative history.
Well, you can make your argument about legislative history, but we've got to make a determination here. And if we don't think legislative history applies, then we're going to have to know what the other answer is. Because it's not you've got to establish ambiguity before you get to legislative history.
Okay.
And you can pick up that case again, but there are legion cases that I could find and cite to you that suggest that ambiguity is the gateway to legislative history. So I've got my cases, and so why don't you tell me if those cases are in fact going to prevail, why the statute is ambiguous. And if it is not ambiguous, then why you win.
Okay. So let me go into this. I think the court should look at the legislative history for four reasons. Number one, Congress has explicitly addressed the issue at bar in the legislative history. And I cited the case about that. Number two, consulting the legislative history is never improper. Three, 11 U.S.C. 348.
What case did you cite for that?
Which one is never improper?
Why consulting legislative history is never improper? Well, sure. Improper maybe not, but premature, yeah. Yes.
Sure. So this is another quote from Judge Brown. Consulting the legislative history is never improper. The Supreme Court has noted repeatedly that when aid to construction of the meaning of words as used in the statute is available, there certainly can be no rule of law which forbids its use.
Well, Mr. Asbeck, we're reviewing Judge Brown's decision, right?
Yes, you are.
Okay, so whether he says that or not is not the determining factor here, is it?
So it's Train versus Call, if I may, I think your question was, what's the case law? It's Train v. Colorado Public Interest Research Group, and that's that quote is Appellant Appendix at 228.
Mr. Asbeck, can I ask a question?
Yes.
If your client had not sold the home, had held on to it and converted, what would the trustee or what would the bankruptcy estate get in that case?
If the client had sold the home, the trustee would get nothing.
Had not sold the home.
Yeah, if the house had not been sold, the analysis would be the same.
So even if they still had the house when they converted to a liquidation proceeding, the trustee would have no interest in the house, in the value of the house?
Correct.
And why is that? I don't understand that.
When the case was filed, the equity in the house was less than the homestead exemption.
Okay, so look.
If I can finish answering the question. And then after the case was filed, the trustee is not entitled to the post-petition appreciation in the house.
And what do you rely on that the trustee is not entitled to post-petition appreciation?
The legislative history to 348F, and if I can
okay.
go back to...
Other than legislative history, do you have either case law or an interpretation of the statute that supports that?
Yeah, I have many case law. I have a great deal of case law set forth in our brief, in our briefs, Section D, starting at page 11. We've got nine cases going back to the year 2000.
Let me ask you this. In the statute, Section 348, in Section FB, it talks about valuations. And it says that that the valuation of property shall apply in a converted case under Chapters 11 and 12, but the valuation in a Chapter 13 does not apply in Chapter 7. To me, by saying that, they're saying the valuation during the reorganization case is not fixed. That section to me seems inconsistent with the idea that you can rely on how the house was valued at the time that the Chapter 13 was filed. What do we do with that section in terms of changing valuation?
Well, what we do with that section is we look at the approach that Judge Brown took is we look at the valuation of the house at the time the case was filed. And that's how much the house was worth when the case was filed. So we have one
Isn't
issue.
Isn't that directly contrary to what I just read from subsection B? It says that the valuation you do look to the valuation of when you filed the Chapter 13 in a Chapter 11 or 12 conversion, but not in a Chapter 7 conversion. I mean, if that were different, I think you'd have a pretty good argument if that were the other way around, is that that section says valuations remain fixed. But I don't think that's what it says.
Okay. Well, I disagree that... In this case, you look at the value of the house when the case was filed. And 348, the statute that you're referring to does not apply in this case because the trustee is not entitled to the post-petition appreciation. And if I can get back to, I've only got 3 minutes left here.
Well, whether the trustee is entitled to post-petition appreciation is what we're here to decide, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. And going back to your question, Judge Holmes, about why is 348F ambiguous, let's start off with this. We have two bankruptcy judges who've come to differing opinions about what the meaning of 348F1A is, okay? Judge Brown said, in our case, that it means that the trustee is not entitled to the post-petition appreciation. Judge Romero, on the other hand, found that the trustee is entitled to the post-petition appreciation. So in Colorado, in the Tenth Circuit, statutory language is ambiguous if it is capable of being understood by reasonably well-informed persons in two or more different senses. And I think the bankruptcy appellate panel rightfully found that there could be no better example of a statute which is interpreted in two different senses than these two opposing opinions of Judge Brown and Judge Romero.
If I disagree with you that there's something unique about the personal residence here, the homestead exemption, and and I look at other assets of the debtor, and you know the stock that was worth $100 at filing and is worth $1,000 at conversion. Does the trustee get the $1,000 or the $100 if those are sold?
The stock?
Yeah.
I would argue the trustee gets the value when the case was filed. But Judge...
So the appreciation would go...
To the debtor. But Judge, again, let me point out something that I think the Tenth Circuit may not be familiar with. In a Chapter 7 case, if the debtor has a house and a Chapter 7 case is filed, let's say the house, there's less equity than the homestead exemption. At that point, the debtor can file a motion to abandon the house from the estate, okay? And so that cuts off, if that motion is granted, the trustee cannot recover the appreciation and the value of the house. That's what would normally happen in a Chapter 7 case, is the debtor takes that house out of the estate because it's of no value to the state. In this case, that was not an option for the debtor because the debtor started in a Chapter 13. The house appreciated for 3 years and then it was converted. So the trustee's approach is an end run around the possibility, is an end run around the fact that he couldn't recover the appreciation of the house in a case normally filed as a Chapter 7. So it's the worst of both worlds for the debtor. It's the best of both worlds for the trustee in this case.
Are you saying you'd have to file a motion to abandon in every 13?
Well, yeah, that's not really done. Motions to abandon are really not filed in the 13 because the property revests with the debtor. When the Chapter 13 plan is confirmed, that property revests with the debtor. There's no reason to file a motion to abandon, okay, as there would be in a Chapter 7. And just briefly, I've gone over my time here.
Go ahead.
The legislative history to 341 F1A clearly states that Congress does not want to disincentivize debtors from filing Chapter 13 for fear of losing their houses. That's explicitly stated. So we have a very explicitly stated public policy goal of not disincentivizing people from filing 13. And I can think of few things that would be more disincentivizing to people from filing a 13 than the prospect of losing their house in the event that the 13 does not work out. And just bear in mind that 13s can be converted voluntarily or involuntarily. So you could have someone in a Chapter 13 who loses their house under the trustee's approach because it's involuntarily converted to a Chapter 7. So when the court talks about wanting to find an umbrella approach to assets, please bear that in mind as well.
All right, counsel. We appreciate the arguments. Your time has expired. Very interesting and difficult case in my perspective. So we'll take it under advisement, and you are excused.
Thank you, Your Honor.